What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Welcome to Hollywood and Levine.
Yes, welcome. I'm Ken Levine, your podcast host. Okay, good guest this week. Actually, this week and next, Mark Evanier is with me. Now, a lot of you know Mark as a blogger. He has one of the top blogs on the entire internet called News From ME, News From Me. And he is also, let's see, an accomplished comic book writer, sitcom writer. He worked on Welcome Back, Kotter. He is a terrific cartoonist. He is the producer-director of the Garfield cartoon series. He wrote a book on Jack Kirby, the guy who pretty much invented most of the Marvel Universe. And he has produced TV variety shows. Boy, this guy is busy. Mark Evanier, a two-parter because I want to get into all of that. And in the first part, we're really going to concentrate on the comic book world and especially Jack Kirby. Now, Jack Kirby is a guy who worked for DC Comics. He worked for Marvel Comics, and he created such characters as Captain America, Thor, the Fantastic Four, X-Men, the Avengers, Black Panther. Unbelievable. I mean, this guy is pretty much the Babe Ruth of graphic comics, and yet a lot of people don't know much about him. Well, we're going to learn about him and that whole world of Marvel DC Comics in part one, my interview with Mark Evanier, right here on
Hollywood and Levine.
You've been involved in many pursuits, but it seems to me your first love is cartooning and comic books.
To a certain extent. Most of the pursuits were covered by Stu Mundell and Chopper 2 overhead. No, I decided I wanted to be a writer when I was about six, and I wasn't sure why I wanted to be a writer of. I wanted to write comic books. I wanted to write cartoons. I wanted to write live-action TV shows. I wanted to write books. TV shows took a big leap when I went to see the Dick Van Dyke Show being filmed at age 12 or so. And so I just
thought, give you a carton of Kent cigarettes?
No. Actually, you had to be 15 to go to a filming. But my family and I ran into Maury Amsterdam in the airport, and he gave us his business card. He gave me his business card and said, "Here, call this number." He put a number on the back of it, and he said, "Call this lady." I think her name was actually Marge, the same name as, the writer's secretary there, and come to a filming, and I'll introduce you to Mary and Dick and, and Rose and everybody like that. So we called up. We made an appointment. We went there, and it was an episode Maury Amsterdam was not in. But I did get to meet Dick very briefly,
right?
And I got to see Mary Tyler Moore in person. I have never, to this day, seen anything that looked as good as Mary Tyler Moore. And it wasn't just the first time I'd ever seen her in person. It was the first time I'd seen her in color. And Persky and Denoff, I figured out who they were. They weren't introduced, but I figured out
these
two guys in sweaters were there with notebooks, and people were coming up to them and asking them about a line or something like that. And even at that age, I knew I was never going to be a performer, nor have I ever had any desire to be one. But I looked at those guys and I said, I think I could do what they did, what they're doing. I think I could be part of it. They seemed important there, and people liked them. And I thought, okay, this is my chance. That's a job where you get to be near people who look like Mary.
Uh-huh. And yeah, you get to marry Laura Petrie. That's one of the reasons why I became a writer.
Right, that's right.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if I told you this story ever, but I met Mary Tyler Moore once, and I literally, and I swear this is true, I stepped on her foot, which, if you remember, that's how Rob met Laura.
That's true.
In one of the flashbacks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I felt terrible about it, and I apologized incessantly, and she was kind of icy to me.
Well, I worked with her. David Isaacs and I created a show for her in 1985, and she specifically said, I do not want Mark Evanier in the audience.
That would do it.
She remembered.
Well, you know, when she did the variety show before that.
Right.
I got this call one time. My agent calls me and he says, Arnie Rosen is going to be doing the new Mary Tyler Moore variety show. He wants you to come in and talk about writing for it. And I had worked with Arnie Rosen, and I didn't like Arnie Rosen. And I thought, why does Arnie Rosen want me? He doesn't like me. And I didn't like him. So I didn't go in. And I found out later it was Arnie Kogan. It was
a very different
Arnie,
person.
A totally different person. And my agent had just confused the names. So I never went in, but I think I was fortunate I was not on that show. So
That was a very difficult show. That's an interesting show if you can find any copies of it on YouTube. I mean, among the supporting players were David Letterman,
Michael Keaton,
yeah. Swoosie Kurtz, yeah.
Yeah, everybody was good on that show except Mary,
yeah.
I think.
Well, same thing on our show. anyway.
You had John Astin, right?
Yeah, we did. We had a great cast. We had John Astin. We had Katie Sagal. We gave Katie Sagal her first job. If we would have had Christine Ebersole starring in the show, it would have gone 8 years. But
It wouldn't have gotten on properly with Christine Ebersole.
No, that's absolutely true.
All right. So I just wanted to be a writer, and I figured I'll just take whatever avenues are open to me. And comic books, which were a passion of mine for years, were the easiest entry thing for me. And I was invited, I was asked by editors to submit scripts to them. And then I met this man named Jack Kirby, who
is a legend.
A genuine, bona fide creative genius.
Describe Jack Kirby for people who don't know who
he is. Well, Jack Kirby was the most important creator of comic books, probably, certainly of adventure-type comic books. And he and his partner, Joe Simon, created Captain America in the early 40s.
Okay.
They created a lot of very successful comics. They were the preeminent creative team. Siegel and Shuster, you know, created Superman, but that was their one real shot. Simon and Kirby were always creating new comics. They invented romance comics. And then they broke up in the 50s, and Jack wound up at Marvel Comics, where he and Stan Lee started the Fantastic Four and the Thor and the X-Men and the Avengers and all these things which are now billion-dollar properties.
Mm-hmm.
And people always say to me, Jack passed away in the early 90s. They said, well, what would he have thought of all this? And I said, he would have said, I told you so. He would have said it lovingly and sweetly without any ego. Mm-hmm. But he would have said, of course, yes. And one of the reasons he never got his due financially was because the people he was working for had no vision of what this stuff could be worth. He did. He was a guy who talked strangely out of sync with the world sometimes. He was out of sync with the present because he was always in the future. And he couldn't drive a car because he would drive off the road. His mind would wander and he couldn't. But he would sit down at the drawing table every day with a pile of blank paper and a pencil. And it was a ratty little. I had a better drawing board than Jack Kirby at home. And he would create these visions and things. And everything he did, other writers later have had inspiration to create, to build upon. Everything he did was a foundation for something. So the Black Panther was kind of a throwaway character that he started, and now it's the biggest, hottest movie in the world. And the X-Men and all these things and minor villains. He had a villain when he was working for DC Comics named Darkseid, who will probably be the villain in almost every DC Comics movie of the foreseeable future, or would be part of it. He was such a great villain. And a lot of people think that Darth Vader in the Star Wars series was a ripoff of Darkseid. a lot of similarities there. But the point was that he just kept coming up with ideas and new ideas, and he was a sweet, wonderful man, but he had a New York accent, and he talked a little like Jimmy Cagney in a bad movie, and his mind would wander. He would just start talking to you about one thing, and then he'd be talking about something else, and he'd talk about something else, and you'd look at him and go, yeah, sure, Jack, with no idea what he was talking about. And then weeks, months later, you'd go, oh, I get it. He was talking about, he was continuing another conversation, and he jumped. He made weird associations in his life.
Judd Hirsch does that too.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hirsch does that too.
Can he
great
draw?
Guy.
Can he draw?
Great guy. Remember once being on the Paramount lot with Glenn and Les Charles, and we came upon Judd, and they had worked with him on Taxi. And so we're walking across the lot with him, and he's talking about this and that. I have no idea because he's just jumping from topic to topic. And when we finally separate, I said, what was he talking about? And they said to me, we thought you knew.
Yeah. Well, Jack was like that, but it was always – it was worth the time to figure out what he was saying because it was really sometimes just brilliant. And – he never got the financial rewards in his lifetime because he's working for these people who thought, you know, oh, the Black Panther, that's not worth much. We're not going to pay him much for that. That's not a value. The guy who he worked for at Marvel sold the company, Jack used to say, for about the price that Ant-Man was worth. He sold Spider-Man, the Hulk, the X-Men, Captain
wow.
America.
Wow.
All that for this, you know, it was that, when Colonel Sanders sold his empire for $2 million and thought that was what KFC, and that was a lot of money.
Right.
In Austin Powers context. And so Jack just was working for people who didn't understand what he was giving them. And what he gave me was not much money. I didn't work for him for money. I worked for him for just that glow of being around a genius.
What did you do for him? You wrote?
I wrote some things which he didn't need. It was like busy. Oh, I want to give Mark a chance. Here, you can write this thing. You can write this. And he absolutely didn't need me. He could have written something better in the time it took him to read what I wrote and figure out how to fix it. He could have easily written something better. But I did odd jobs. I actually was able, I drew one thing better than Jack. I drew Superman's emblem better than he did. So I would occasionally draw a Superman's emblem when he was drawing a Superman comic.
I would
draw it in. Or I'd fix a little drawing mistake. He once drew an issue of a comic the wrong size. We did the comic book original art. This is the image area on the original art was 10 by 15, 10 inches by 15.
Okay.
But we were in a special couple books. There were magazines that were 11 by 17. And then he drew an issue of Jimmy Olsen, which I was working on with him, 11 by 17 accidentally. There's two piles of paper. Because he was absent-minded. That's like the way he couldn't drive a car. He couldn't figure out how to use a ruler, or he couldn't figure out how to... his wife had to order for him in restaurants. He could never decide what to order in the restaurants. We'd go to an Italian restaurant. He'd say, "I want a hamburger," and they'd say, "We don't have hamburgers." "Oh, I want a hamburger," and his wife would go, "No, give him this instead. Give him a meatball sandwich."
How long would it take him to draw a comic book?
Well, he did them in 2 days if he had to.
Wow.
For emergencies. He once did an issue of Captain America. He once did an issue of Captain America in 2 days where he was filling in. Another person was doing the book. And at the end of one issue, Captain America apparently died. Because in comic books, every hero has to die every couple of months. And then, oh, my God, next issue of his comic, he comes back. So they called up Jack and said, "You got to do a fill-in of Captain America on here." And he said, "Okay, what's the continuity I've got to pick up?" He said, "Well, Captain America's dead." And he said, "Well, okay, so you want me to bring him back?" "No, you got to keep him dead till the next issue, which is already half drawn." So he had to do 20 pages of Captain America over the weekend with Captain America dead.
Wow.
And he did it.
His background, he must have been a fine artist because his anatomy, the characters, you know, the anatomy was really well done.
Well, the anatomy was really weird. It was not. I mean, you could look at his figure, Jack Drew, and go, "What's that muscle?" And you have no idea. he made up his own anatomy. He made up his own mythology. He made up his own language. He created visual language and verbal language, And there are people who get nuts because he drew kind of square fingertips. Well, he liked square fingertips. and you know, ordinarily, when he was working at a comfortable pace, he would do about 2 to 3 pages a day. But the thing that was impressive about Jack was not just how fast he was, but how hard he worked. There was a day in my life, when people always say to me, what did you learn from this guy? And that's we could build 12 of your podcasts with that. But one of the key things was I looked at him one day and I said to myself, Mark, you're never going to have that kind of native brilliance. You're never going to be as creative as this man. You're certainly never going to draw as well as he did. I kind of gave up drawing a lot when I worked for Jack. Like, what's the point? It's right. Like, you know, following around Tiger Woods with your putter.
Right.
But I thought it might be possible to work that hard. It might be possible to commit to every job so to stay up all night if you have to do it over and over until you get the way you want it. I could do that. And so I learned a lot of work habits from him, work ethics. And there were times when now when I'm writing something and I'm tired and I go, well, this is good enough. And I think, no, Jack would have erased this. If this was a combo page, Jack would have erased it and done it over.
Wow.
Even though what he had done the first was perfectly fine. But he had to always give 110% on everything, even when he knew the work would be mauled by others down the assembly line, even when he knew that he'd be swindled on the money. Even though he knew that the printing was terrible, he knew the printing in the comics he was doing was terrible. And you know, these were 12-cent and 15-cent comic
right.
books.
We're talking the '60s, and
I was working for him in 1970.
Okay,
and the comics were 15 cents at that point, and they were printed on the worst paper stock back then. There was never a case of any comic book publisher ever saying, oh, no, we can't do that to the comics. We've got to do a better job on printing.
Yeah, if anybody came
to them and said, we've got a cheaper paper, we've got a cheaper kind of printing plate, they went, fine, we'll take it. So Jack would put all this intricate detail and all this extra energy, way more than anybody else who was being paid the same rates was doing. And if you said to him, Jack, why are you putting so much into this? He'd say, well, because someday this stuff's going to be reprinted on good paper. And nobody thought that at the time but him. And, of course, right now you go to a comic book shop and you can buy about 75% of his life's work printed in hardcover, deluxe paper, embossed covers and things like that. He knew that was going to happen to the work. He was that pressured. The amazing...
Wish he would have warned us about Trump.
Oh, he did. He did. If you go back now, people are looking at old Kirby comics and going, hey, there's Trump. He did a thing in... book I did with him called The Forever People. He had a character named Glorious Godfrey, who was a combination of Arthur Godfrey and Billy Graham.
Okay.
Jack was a very liberal Democrat. I don't think he ever voted Republican in his life. And he thought that Billy Graham, this is 1970, was the most dangerous man on the planet, because Billy Graham was just praying for the Earth's destruction and, you know, the rebirth and all that stuff, and getting people psyched up to believe that the world was going to end next Tuesday. And so he took the folksy charm of Arthur Godfrey and embedded it in Billy Graham. If Billy Graham had been able to communicate as well as Arthur Godfrey,
okay,
it's a little bit like his version of A Face in the Crowd, mm-hmm. to some extent.
Great movie, yeah.
But you can read...
Andy Griffith.
Go
yeah.
back and read those, and you can find analogies to Mr. Trump. They're a little strained at some point, but you still have somebody who's...
The hair has got to be better.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
It's got to be better.
Well, he had Arthur Godfrey's hair in the character,
okay.
but which was not that different. But the story was essentially about someone appealing to someone's inner fears and base instincts and appealing to the worst of people's, you know, terror uh-huh. of the unknown, to their tribalism. And the analogy only goes so far. There's a lot of stuff in Glorious Godfrey that has no connection to Donald Trump or any demagogue we've had in any political party. But the thing was that Jack wasn't writing stories about robbing the bank. He wasn't writing stories about bank robbers, and he wasn't writing stories about we have to, you know, someone stealing the Kloppman diamond. He wasn't doing that kind of thing. He was writing stories about human interaction and people and the types you. He wrote a lot of stories about abuse of power. That was a constant theme. And this villain of his that he had called Darkseid that I mentioned had a lot of Richard Nixon in him. Jack would take the thing, the brilliance he had was he would take something in the news that interested him and he would fashion a whole story around it. And you couldn't really figure out easily what he was talking about. He did a famous story in the Fantastic Four where this character named Galactus is coming in to basically eat Earth. He's a guy who feasts on planets. And there's this big war that goes on about, and the Fantastic Four managed to save the Earth from Galactus. And I read the story, and it was a very powerful story. And it was a story driven by Jack. He worked with Stan Lee on a lot of these Marvel comics. And there's somewhere you can tell Jack was the dominant creative force, since, which is not to say Stan did not make a contribution. But, you know, as you know, partnerships, teams are not always 50-50. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you probably with David, you know,
done a story that's 80-20 me.
Yeah, that's right.
Time.
Yes, of course. Yes.
Yeah.
He told me the same thing, but it was kind of reversed. Yeah. But and what Jack was writing about in his head, and I don't know if this was ever in Stan Lee's head, was corporate raiders who were going in and feasting on corporations and leaving them as which was he was terrified was going to happen because Marvel was up for sale at the time. And he was very frightened.
And it did happen.
Yeah, it did. It did happen. And the guy who bought it was famous for doing that, for buying a company. It's the guy who bought Marvel was the guy who bought Saturday Evening Post and destroyed it.
Yeah, kind of a Gordon Gekko guy.
Yeah. And so Jack was – so if you really got into it, you'd understand the subtext of that Fantastic Four sequence was – partially, not completely, because Jack never did stories about one thing, partially about the this thing that was happening where you had a wonderful company and everybody's life depended on it. Everybody had made their paychecks from it. And somebody would come in, strip it of its asset, leave it a hollow, you know, framework, and move on, which is what Galactus was going to do with Earth, except the Fantastic Four appealed to his herald, who was a throwaway character of Jack's called the Silver Surfer.
Okay.
That he just stuck in the story. He said, Galactus needs a herald. We'll put the Silver Surfer. And that's how he created. He would just add a character. They come up out of nowhere. There was one time I was working with him, and DC Comics asked him to come up with a new comic about monsters and evil, you know, ghosting type thing, something macabre. Because they, at that moment, thought that was the new trend in comics. It really wasn't, but, you know.
Okay.
DC was a very dysfunctional company at the time. So we went to dinner. Jack, his wife, my partner, myself, Jack's kids. We all drove to a Howard Johnson's right near the house. Jack lived out in Thousand Oaks. And I remember ordering a hot turkey sandwich. I don't know why I remember that. And Jack is sitting there quietly. He let his wife order for him, and he's just sitting there. Conversation's going around him. And about the time they brought our entrees and we were going to stop talking and eat, Jack went, okay, here's the comic. And he had figured out the entire demon storyline, the character called the demon. He'd figured it out in 20 minutes. And it sounded like something that somebody else had worked on for 6 months. And he went home from that dinner and drew the first portrait of the demon and started jotting down notes. He had it all in his head. And every single thing that appeared in that comic, and it was a very good comic, was fabulous, you know, was what was created while they were making my hot turkey sandwich.
Great story. He was
like that. Yeah.
Great story.
So you know, I didn't make any money working for Jack, really, but I just had the experience of being, I've been fortunate to be around a lot of people who I admired and who were just brilliant. I worked with Stan Freberg, as you know, a lot. Mm-hmm. And I got to work with the most brilliant actor I think who's ever lived, a man named Dawes Butler.
Right, who did voices. We're going to talk about cartoon voices because I know there's a lot of people who want to get into that business. But first, I want to go chronologically.
Yeah.
and turned to TV writing because you became a sitcom writer. Yeah. You were on Welcome Back, Kotter. Yeah. At the time, my partner and I were trying to break in. We couldn't even get in to pitch stories to Welcome Back, Kotter.
Well, you did okay.
Yeah,
you
we do. Fine. Yeah, we
as
did we, okay.
As we sit here surrounded by your Emmys and your credits, I'm not feeling sorry for you.
How'd you make that change?
I was writing comic books, and I was starting to write a little bit for some stand-up comedians I knew. I had this weird idea, which made a little sense. I never really planned career much, but I had this idea that I was writing comic books, and I could segue from writing comic books to writing TV cartoons. I was writing the Scooby-Doo comic book, and I thought, well, maybe I can send some Scooby-Doo comic books to the guy story editing the show and say, why don't you, you know, hire me to write the TV show? Here's an example of how I can write Scooby-Doo. And it turns out that they just took the storylines and did them without me.
It's never happened before. Anyway, that's a very unique story.
But I went the other way around. I went from comic books to live action, then to animation, which nobody had done at the time, to my knowledge. Well, yeah, I take it back. Alan Burns had
right.
kind of done that.
Who created the Mary Tyler Moore Show. Yeah.
Yeah.
He wrote on Rocky and Bullwinkle.
Right,
and,
yeah. That's right, yeah. Anyway, I think Lloyd Turner also had done that, but
right.
not a lot of
he ended up doing the Jeffersons and hired me and David,
and
our first
job.
And
now I'm thinking of other people. Jerry Belson did that. And
yeah, Jerry Belson worked. Jerry Belson is this great comedy writer. Used to write with Gary Marshall, and he started by writing Chilly Willy cartoons.
That's right, yeah. Yeah, when I worked for Western Publishing, which published the Gold Key comics of Hanna-Barbera and Disney and Warner Brothers, they started referring to me as the new Jerry Belson. When I met Jerry Belson, I told him that, and he said, "I'm the new Jerry Belson. You can't be the new Jerry Belson."
Tell you one quick Jerry Belson story, because we worked together on Cheers, and when my son Matt was born, he sent a gift along with a note that's in Matt's baby book, and it said, "Dear Matthew, always remember I was funnier than your father." You know what? He's right, too.
He was a funny man, yeah. Anyway, so I was writing comic books and such, and I was running the comic book department for the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate. I was running Tarzan. Korak, mm-hmm. And I met this guy named Dennis Palumbo, who was a He's from Pittsburgh. I don't even know where Dennis was born, but he was from Pittsburgh. He'd been in the advertising business there. He'd come out here to try to get into TV writing. And he had found, and you know this well, that at that moment, if you wanted to write sitcoms, you had to come in twos. You needed a partner. I don't think anybody broke in who as a solo there, except maybe Treva Silverman. Mm-hmm.
A future guest, by the way.
Good. Yeah. She's a brilliant, funny person.
Yep.
I called her Trina. The last time I saw her, I have a friend named Trina Robbins, a comic book writer, and I called Treva Trina, and I'm still living that down.
It's interesting because she did write me a note saying, "I'm happy to do the podcast unless Mark Evanier."
Yeah,
you just, you leave a trail wherever you go.
And so does a snail. Dennis needed a partner. He realized that, and what had happened, oddly enough, was that Dennis knew a little bit about me from the comic book world, and I had written a fan letter to him. He wrote a book called The World's Greatest TV Trivia Test. It was a paperback book that came out. It was a book of TV trivia, but it was a funny book of TV trivia. And on a whim, and I almost never did this, I just wrote a letter to the author and care of the publisher and said, "Hey, I just wanted to tell you that was one of the funniest books I've ever read and such." And so he had my phone number, or he had my address at least, whatever. And I get this call one day, and he says, "Hey, I'm trying to write TV. You want to get together for lunch and talk about stuff?" And I said, "Okay." And we hit it off, and I found he was a very bright, smart guy. And as writers, we were probably at that stage about evenly matched in terms of experience and ability, but he was way ahead of me in pitching and talking and selling. I was really bad. I've never gotten good at it, but I was even worse then than I am now. But fortunately, Dennis was able to make some connections and get us a couple meetings. And we met a man named Herb Solo, who at the time, Herb Solo, people remember his name. He was the over the end credits the original Star Trek, and Herb Solo, executive right. in charge of production. He was working for Hanna-Barbera, trying to sell live-action shows. Hanna-Barbera wanted to get into live-action more. They brought him in because he had credibility in that area. We pitched him an idea, and he loved it. And he said, "You guys got any balls?" And I said, "You know, Dennis, let's check. We can go to the men's room and check if you'd like." And he said, he called up CBS, and he made an appointment with the top guy. He says, "I'm bringing in two beginners. I believe in these guys so much. They've got the best idea in the world." Now, what had happened actually was that he had asked us to come up with an idea for Jack Klugman. The Odd Couple had ended, and he knew the networks all wanted to have the next Jack Klugman vehicle. Somebody was going to develop a Jack Klugman pilot somewhere.
Right.
So he said, "Come up with an idea for Jack Klugman," and we decided we would go in and not mention Jack Klugman. We would pitch this idea and wait for the guys in the network to say, "Hey, you know who'd be perfect for this?" And they would think that it was their idea,
okay.
Which it would be, I guess, in mm-hmm. that case. So then all of a sudden, having never been, you know, in a TV studio except as audience really before, although I was poaching a lot at NBC. I was always, you want to hear about me sneaking through the halls at NBC at some point. We are pitching to the head of vice president of comedy at CBS. And they liked the idea. It was, you know, you've had good pitches and bad pitches.
Sure.
We had a good pitch when it mattered. It really went very well. And they said to us, basically, "We love this idea." Nobody said Klugman until Herb finally said, "Well, what about Klugman?" I mean, oh, okay. That part of the strategy didn't work. But they loved the idea. But they had already commissioned a pilot, very similar, same arena. And they said, "We don't want to have two shows in the same setting. We will option yours," which I think they did kind of like a charity case for us. They said, thought it would be,
all right, you know, still money. They optioned it.
They optioned it from us. And they said, "If the other pilot falls through, we'll reactivate yours. In the meantime, come up with something else for us." So the other pilot was Alice.
Oh.
Which was only on for like 900 years.
Well, it's off now. Go back.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, our show was basically Alice if you had made Vic Tayback the star of it.
Okay. You know, so, diner kind
of deal. Yeah. So, but we had the other supporting characters worked out, and we haven't had the show all cast with people who we knew were available. That was Herb thought, "Here are star, you know, we'd tell him some people we had my, oh, now he's gettable and the networks like him and he's gettable." So we were walking in with, you know, we could put like five of the people they liked into this sitcom. So we all of a sudden got kind of hot for young guys who hadn't had anything produced.
Right.
And we started being recommended for things, and Herb sent us to some agents. And but because the show, if they had picked it up, we were obviously not qualified to be, you know, producers at that stage.
Right.
Or showrunners, the term which was not used.
So they would marry you with experienced
writers. So Herb married us with a guy named Jerry Davis, who had lots of experience producing shows. Jerry had produced The Odd Couple. He'd produced That Girl. He'd produced Bewitched. He'd produced half a dozen. He was as experienced as anybody in the sitcom world. And we met Jerry, and he liked us. And then Jerry got hired as the co-producer, one of the two producers of the Nancy Walker show for Norman Lear, the other one being Arnie Rosen, who I mentioned before. And Jerry brought us into the Nancy Walker show. And they said to us the first day we were there, "Okay, who are your agents?" And we said, "We don't have agents." And they said, "Well, you better get agents." So all of a sudden, we went from not having anybody want us in the business to every agent in town wanted to hire us.
Right.
And Dennis and I had an incredible week that I'm still recovering from.
I know. You eat really well, don't you?
where we went to, I think, about 10 agencies. The 10 top agencies in town, we went to meetings with all of them. And it was fascinating. I never learned so much about television as I did in that week. Because every agent did their dog and pony show for us, and they were, and we signed with Robinson Weintraub, which at that time was the sitcom factory. Everybody on every sitcom was Robinson Weintraub.
Right.
We went to, I'll tell you a quick story. We went to one agency, and the guy sat us down. He was Harlan agent, Harlan Ellison's agent. I was a friend of Harlan's, and he had told me, "Don't sign with that agent until I, you know, check it out." And I called him and said, "We're thinking of this agent." He said, "No, no, go see my guy." So we went to see his guy. He sets us down. And he says, "This is the opening line." Now remember, flashback to the moment when you hadn't sold anything.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
He says, "Now, I'm not good at getting you work." And Dennis and I looked at
is
each other
like, "Good at getting you laid? Like, well, I mean, like, then what?"
here's the pitch. Okay, I'll be the agent for a second. All right, I'm not good at getting you work, but no one will get you more money. I will kill for you. I will get every nickel. I will leave them bleeding. They'll be crying for mercy when they get through negotiating with me. They will be begging. They will be saying, then you'll say to them, "Oh, talk to my agent." They'll go, no, we can't talk to your agent. He'll kill us again. Please, here's all the money." And he just went on about how he was the greatest negotiator in all of show business. And I don't know that he wasn't, but when you're starting out, who wants an agent who's going to kill them and make them beg for mercy? You could just imagine going in, and then they would say, they'd make the deal, and they'd say, "Okay, this better be damn good. You guys, this script had better cure cancer." I mean, so we didn't sign with him, but we signed with Robinson Weintraub, which represented, you know, half the sitcom writers.
Right, yeah.
And the next thing we knew, we were writing a Love Boat. We wrote a Love Boat. We wrote a Love Boat script before Love Boat was the final, in its final version. They had done a TV movie with Don Adams was in it and Florence Henderson, people like that. And it had a different, I think Dick Van Patten was the captain or somebody, different crew.
Okay. You know,
and they hadn't bought the show. We went over to ABC. They screened the pilot for us, and they said, "We're changing the show around. None of these people are going to be on the boat. We're doing another pilot." And at that point, now this is something I seem to be the only person in the world who knows this. Or I guess Dennis remembers it. They said, "We're going to write this show is going to go on at 10 o'clock or maybe even 11 o'clock on Saturday night, and it's going to be more adult. And we're going to film some really adult scenes, including nudity. So we're going to release these as features overseas."
The Love Boat.
The Love Boat was going to be R-rated, uh-huh. And they were going to see how far they could push it. Now this is years before, you know, NYPD Blue,
right.
or mm-hmm. anything like that. You know, Dennis Franz's ass had not been seen, and they wanted us to come up with a script that was really adult and really sexy and controversial. And they said, "Forget about everything that you've ever seen on sitcoms before. We want passion and lust, and we want naked women and maybe some naked men. And there'll be two versions of the script. There'll be the one we run in America, and there'll be the one for overseas." Because at that point, it was not going to be a weekly series. It was going to be a series of like 4 specials a year.
Okay.
By the time we finished our script, that was all gone. And it was now a 9 o'clock show with family values. And the script we wrote didn't make it into the second Love Boat pilot. It didn't make it into the third Love Boat pilot. By the time it got made, it had no resemblance to what we did. And by that point, we were already on doing Cotter.
Right.
And we did the Nancy Walker show. We did the McClane. I tell it this way. We did the Nancy Walker show. We got fired after about 6 weeks, and Nancy got fired after about 12. And then we did the McClane Stevenson show. We got fired after about 4 weeks, and McClane got fired after about 9. And then we got hired on Cotter. That wasn't going anywhere. And we did Cotter for a year. And then we, as friends, decided to go our separate ways. And Dennis and I are still friends. And you should have him on your podcast.
Yeah, Dennis became a therapist and a mystery novelist.
Yes, he's you hear about all these teams that break up and everybody wants to kill each, you know,
right.
far and apart. Dennis and I stayed good friends. We have lunch once a year or so and catch up on things. And he's a very bright guy. We just at one point decided we wanted different things for our careers. And I kind of felt at that moment, if I could go as a solo, I was just more comfortable as a solo. Although I did team up with other writers after Dennis for certain projects.
Okay, that's part one. Part two coming up next week is equally interesting. Mark is going to be talking about an absolutely insane variety show that he worked on called Pink Lady and Jeff. And we're going to get into cartoons and animation, and specifically the voice actors who do the cartoons. Since Mark directs the Garfield series and a number of others, he's going to give you a lot of great tips on how to break into that world, the do's and don'ts, etc. That is next week. Again, thank you so much for being here. Also, thanks to Adam and Susie Meister Butler, to John Wolford, Howard Hoffman, and Randy Thomas. If you have any questions, concerns, you want to get in touch with me for any reason, you may do so. You can just email me at HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. That's HollywoodLevine@Outlook.com. You can follow me on Twitter at Ken Levine, and you can follow me on Instagram, Hollywood and Levine. Thanks so much for listening. See you next week. Bye-bye. Hollywood.